This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard, given on the 16th of August, 1951. The title of this lecture is Motion and Emotion Continued. This tape is 77 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
I'm going to knock you all anaten now by a very simple process of simply reading to you the physiological scale. On this. At tone 4, there's the full control of the autonomic by the cortex, both craniosacral and thoracolumbar systems of autonomic functioning at optimum under direction of cortex. You got that? All right. There's a whole column down, all the way down this page. This page on. Actually, that is a list of the physiological reactions which take place at these various levels. Now, all this makes clear is the fact that the mind has a control and monitoring system which it uses on the body. It actually has two control systems which it employs. The one is simply the control system through the motor controls. You might say it's your mechanical control system. Now, that is the system of levers, weights, balances, and so forth. Very mechanical. And as a matter of fact, it's very amusing data I might throw in here. Somebody found this out with rats, something they really found out with a rat. And I was awfully glad they found out with a rat, because I would have hated for them to have put in all these decades and decades and decades of work with rats without ever having it come to anything. But they found this out about rats, that there were two panels on each side of the rat's skull. And each one was the shape of a rat. Now here's your rat. Boy, that's a terrible looking rat. Anyhow, up here you have a rat hanging by his heels, you might say. And over the top of this rat, you've got another rat. In other words, there's two panels here. And this is one side of his skull, and here's the other side of his skull. Now, here is the nervous system. And here's your monitor control unit, I. But here, this applies strictly to thought. These two panels. This is a rat hanging by his heels, and this is a rat hanging by his heels. It's a panel. It actually looks like the rat. It is as though you had cut out a silhouette of a rat hanging by his heels. One's there and one's there. And here's the rat hanging by his heels again, over here and over here. And this is the motor. This connects up with the muscles. This connects up with the thought, then, and this connects up with the muscles. And this one goes over here to that side of the body on both sides. This comes over here to this side of the body, and they control opposite sides of the body. That's beside the point. But the point is that this rat thinks up cheese, he thinks. And when he thinks cheese, there's a set of, he thinks cheese, and all of a sudden he gets this goes over to the motor control system, he'll move his tongue and start toward a source of cheese. Motor control. But now in a man, you have the same setup, with this exception. The hand and the tongue are enormously exaggerated. The man hanging by his heels, it's actually a picture of a man, but the hand, great big hand, and the tongue is enormously long. You've got a man hanging by his heels, a strip, There are two of them here and two of them here. And they hang down on either side of the head here. Now, this man hangs by his heels here. This is where the thoughts register, evidently, and here's where the muscle control sets up. Now, this controls this side of the body, this controls this side of the body. The thought of, let's say the thought of a steak. It's 5:30. He thinks of steak. He goes through all of the muscular control units impelling himself homeward thinking about steak. Well, that would be all very well except for one thing. The mind is something that controls, the function controls the structure. It is not a subordinate proposition where the structure is controlled by the function. That's very easily proven in a number of ways, but not particularly germane to it. Point is that the mind is running a carbon-oxygen motor. This carbon-oxygen motor is of a low heat engine. The body is the material body is a low heat engine that runs on a carbon-oxygen system. It runs at a temperature of 98.6. And the combustion that takes place makes it possible for these muscles to move and so forth. There's energy being released into these various systems. The mind runs on a oxygen battery system, the like of which is wonderful. It runs on 2.4 watts, by the way. And this battery system makes each little cell around there a battery which furnishes its own power. Now, this stuff you might say, the mind switchboard, whatever the brain has to do with it, the brain certainly handles the switchboard system on that horsepower. Now, there seems to be an additional energy which overlies this and monitors it, which has been overlooked before. This additional energy does not run on carbon-oxygen battery systems. But that's completely beside the point. We can consider it as a carbon-oxygen batteries and carbon-oxygen motors and mechanize the whole thing if we just overlook the directive impulse, I. I thinks, gee whiz, Great Dane, fight, bad situation, I'm in his yard, the gate's right there, run. Now, but all that was a thought computation. Now, what happens? He says, run. Run means that certain muscles have to go into operation. So here's the thought pattern happens here. This says certain muscles must go into operation. There's evidently a switchboard set up here. All of a sudden, these muscles go into that operation, and the fellow runs. Now, that would be very interesting, except for one thing. When you step on a throttle, your motor runs faster. But I never heard of a motor run faster yet that wasn't fed more fuel. You can't sit out there in your automobile and merely go through all the motions of driving fast and even make the car bump and so forth. You won't go any faster unless that motor's traveling faster. The point is how do you step on the accelerator of the human body? Because, strictly speaking, it is just a motor system that you're operating. You step on the accelerator system very simply and very easily. Via the pituitary glands, evidently, a series of catalysts are thrown into the body in such a way as to produce further catalysts via the glandular system, which permit a great deal more fuel to be burned. Now, the fuel is right there, the food and fuel is right there, and what we're doing is adjusting the spark the way you do on an outboard motor instead of adjusting the gasoline. See how this would be? The fuel is right there. More oxygen has to be carried to these areas, true enough. But the food is going to furnish the carbon side of this and part of the oxygen side of this. And it's residual. The energy is right there ready to be burned. Now, before you burn very much of it, a lot more oxygen has to be pumped in. That's why when you see a person under stress, starting to breathe. Now, I'll throw you a little correlated datum. A psychotic breathes that way all the time. That's correlated datum. Now, a lot of them breathe this way. Some of them don't breathe at all. That's apathy. But if he's up on this upper band and completely spun in below 2-0, you get a complete spin in below 2-0, you'll get that fast breathing reaction. Oxygenation, oxygenation, oxygenation. Of course, it isn't going anyplace, doing anything. Maybe threw you a little curve there by mentioning two catalysts. But I mention that because up here in the pituitary gland, there's evidently a series of switches. Just call them that. And you just throw these switches, and this says pancreas, pancreas quarter speed, pancreas half speed. Adrenals quarter speed, adrenals half speed. Adrenals all ahead blank. this little switchboard system right up in here, about the size of a walnut, right back to point. And that's evidently what happens. Now, the glands throw into the bloodstream and throw into the various local areas of the body the stuff that makes the fuel burn faster. There is a certain amount of glandular excretion going on continually. It takes several glandular compounds to produce an optimum fuel. The glands that produce these compounds are in various parts of the body, and they're on to greater or lesser degree. But to get a fuel mixture, it's all very well to say it's a carbon-oxygen motor, but it's a carbon-oxygen motor plus the spark plug. It's a gasoline engine with a spark plug in it. It's not a diesel engine without a spark plug. The spark plug is simply glandular fluid. That glandular fluid has to be released into the body so that when this says so fast, and this says all of a sudden run, and the muscles of the body working down here get this order, and they go on and they run, you wouldn't get any action like you're stepping on an accelerator unless this part of the body said run two. It says run. So you get muscular reaction, and then you get run, and you get the rest of the catalyst fed into the body. We don't even have to interest ourselves to how many kinds of these catalysts there are, because there are certain reactions that have to take place. Now, you get different mixtures of glandular fluid to produce various types of reaction. This glandular system also commands the kind and type of action which is necessary. You get this muscular action, and if you don't get your... This says this. It says anger. All right? This says fight, but your muscle pattern of fight, you're not going to get a fight reaction unless this thing monitors up and says fight too. So this says fight, attack, anger, muscle reaction, so forth. Calling all neurons, you know. I mean, they really go into action. There's this beautiful coordinating system worked up, and this eye sits up there on the throne and says, well, it looks to me like we're going to have to fight, boys. And they suddenly start throwing it in the line. The body gets all prepared, armament, so on. As a matter of fact, part of fighting consists of rigidity and toughening up, actually armor plating of the muscle, armor plating the skin, and so forth. A lot of things happen that are fantastic. Now, part of action is moisture in the palms, so that you get moist palms that holds on to things better. Also, the moisture comes onto the soles of the feet. People can stick to rocks better. It's all conditioned to be done without shoes, you see. And a slightly moist foot will stick to a rock better than one that isn't moist, so that you get perspiration. Now, there are all sorts of these glandular combinations to produce various physical conditions to meet these various motion conditions. Now, the condition of anger, the fellow's going to get mad. That means he's going to attack. He armor plates himself to some degree. His energy level goes way up so that he can go ahead and do this. And his blood starts speeding up. And his respiration, however, doesn't until he sees he's losing the fight. And then you get a completely different order that goes through, and that says, get away from here. Now, motion away, slow retreat, is about the first thing that he would get from anger. You see, that's just down the tone scale that much. But there's a whole endocrine pattern that says motion away, retreat. Now, the action required to retreat away is fear. We recognize that as fear. That's the beginnings of fear, motion away, retreat. And you get real fear, it's motion away, violent. And here you get another kind of catalyst. And you get something else happening that is very interesting. You get the body squaring itself around so as to be inedible. If you've ever run into a person who was in a rather chronic fear state, body odor, very, very bad body odor usually, comes out from this flea. A person who is afraid can be smelled very easily. Not only can dogs smell him, a human being can smell another human being who is afraid. But it's a lousy smell. Actually, it's a poison, which makes the body inedible. If you ever shot a deer that had seen you, was running, was trying to get away from you, you shoot the deer. I don't care how many glands you cut out of that deer, how you try to sweeten up his mate, you sure know it. As a matter of fact, it's a very foolish thing to shoot a deer who is very, very frightened unless you're awful, awful hungry, because they're practically inedible. Now, that, by the way, comes on full by grief. That's really on by grief. But it recedes in apathy. The body says, all right, eat me. Well, now you see, resentment is just a little bit of the mobilization of anger. It's just a preparatory alert. And then comes anger. And then this object is not going to surrender quite as fast as I thought. It's not quite as killable. And so we get the propulsion back, and we get the preparation not to be eaten. And then we get on away, and there's apathy. But as you come up the line from there, you get greater and greater freedom of action, and you don't get over-preparation. Now, at the level of 1.5, you get tremendous over-preparation. If a 1.5 dramatizes 1.5, it's very terrific. Here, this fellow's adrenaline at 1.5, the adrenal glands and so forth, are on full. And here's where you get this is the pitch. They get frozen as they go down the tone scale, more and more frozen into a standardized reaction. As you select people, here's people all the way down the tone scale, any point where you find one of these people, you will find the glands on which are demanding a certain action. It's as though you had stuck the throttle on a railroad locomotive. It's going to travel at a certain speed. It's as though the throttle were stuck or the clutch was stuck and the steering wheel was frozen on a car. And it's just about as safe as that. And you get anger, the fellow's adrenals will be too much, and so on. Now, you get fear. You get all the various mixtures of glands which cause the fear reaction and so forth. They're on. And this guy hasn't got a chance. The throttle's stuck. It's always on here. It says, go away. I've got to leave here. The body is being continually furnished the glandular substances necessary to make the guy get away from there anyhow, because you get a kickback reaction. He's afraid functionally, which puts the function into operation. It comes back up and makes him afraid. He says, be afraid. It says, be afraid. Be afraid, be afraid, be afraid. You get this echoing reaction in these various things. And it just keeps intensifying. This is very important to know how an individual gets stuck on the various level of a tone scale. How come he gets stuck? What fixes him? Well, his motion has been impeded too often. His motion has been impeded, actual motion. And you have gotten an interposition here. These are these little men hanging by their heels. I would not be a bit surprised with what there wasn't a double set of pituitaries there. There is the anterior and the posterior, but the darn little is known about this pituitary setup. The British know more about it than we do, evidently. I was reading on a British publication one day, and I think there were 28 new substances had been discovered in the pituitary that we knew nothing about. And this thing was about 4 years old. We didn't know about it in this country. What's happened here? And if you're interested in training, take a quick look at this. I gives orders to here, to here, to here. This takes over and goes through the reactions. But we'll just postulate that this thing is double in some fashion or other. I don't know that there's the anterior and posterior, but it isn't quite the same double system as this. And you've got I. He's commanded this various reaction system. And as long as I stays in control, you get a very nice smooth flow from here to here, here to here, here to here. You get this nice smooth flow of action. Smooth. Very nice. I don't care what happens to this person. This person can be all bunged up. If this flow of self-determined action, this is self-determinism, can keep on operating, if this can keep on operating smoothly, he's all right. This happens. And this happens. And possibly this. But this to a much less extent than the other. So we'll just not consider it. Somebody comes along and puts an interposition between the nervous panel and the motor panel. How do you do that? That's very simple. Step up here a minute, would you? I'll show you how you put an interposition between the motor panel. I want you to lift your arm. Lift your arm. Go ahead, lift your arm. Aha! Covert hostility. All right, lift this arm. Lift this arm. Lift the arm. Gee. Now, if I kept at this for a long time, you'd probably go into apathy on moving this arm. Go ahead, move the arm. Move the arm. You know what will happen eventually? If you take a little, that's it, tiredness, apathy. So you take a little kid, and every time that you said to the little child, if you told him positively, move his arm, eventually the words, move your arm, would mean that he held it still and was being held back in one place. So the words don't mean a darn thing. That's just opposite. That's just an opposite reaction, don't you see? That the words don't mean anything. Words are just so much. I'll show you the force of words. You want to try this when you get out of here. You want to know about the force of language. Why, as you're talking, put your hand about this distance from your mouth.
and feel the terrible force of those words. Listen, we built up this enormous magical illusion. This is language, not this. The child has to be moved in life. The child tries to move himself. Tries to move himself, and somebody says, no, you don't. Only he doesn't know what no, you don't means. So the grown-up says, that's silly. There he is, 4 months old, and he doesn't know no, you don't yet. The child says, and does a resurgence, and the parent says, and we get this tug of war. And when a child is trained, this has happened. What you've done is train his motor responses to follow you and words, not I. You've trained his motor responses to follow you and words, not I. You have trained him to expect exterior direction or command, and it depends to a large degree on how persistent life has been in training up his muscle systems. Now, when you first restrain this, let's have a child sit on your lap. You're not restraining him at all. He's just sitting there. Self-determinism and the ability to move self are synonymous. Utterly synonymous. Self-determinism and ability to move self. On own choice, that's it. There sits the child. He's comfortable. You're not bothering him. He's perfectly contented. He's not squirming. Now, just reach out and put your hands around the child. Don't touch the child. Just put your hands around him to that degree. And the child says, uh-oh. And says, like this. Now, hold him tighter. And he says, now hold him much tighter. Just don't let him go. He'll keep squirming, and he'll get mad. I don't care how old this child is. This child may be only 6, 7 months old. This child get mad and furious. As a matter of fact, if you haven't gotten him beaten into a proper civilized state of mind, he'll probably bite you or something. And if you go on letting him get mad, then he'll get afraid. There's some reason why he's being held. And he'll try to get away. And if he can't flee along that line, he'll cry. And at the end of his tears, he will go into apathy if you're cruel enough and you've got that much patience. You haven't said a word to him. And you've brought him all the way down the tone scale. Of course, there is a point there in fear where fleeing goes into misdirection. He may start to think there for a minute. He's anger and goes down into fear and tries to get away. You'll get him in a misdirection. The misdirection will be lying very still for just an instant. And then you relax your grip for a second and strike through. A misdirection, but if he goes down to tears, he'll drop off into apathy right below tears. And he won't try to get away, and he'll lie there. If you ever really want an obedient child, if you just repeat that often enough, he'll do anything you want. Nice little rabbit. Of course, he won't ever amount to anything, but that's the point. I read in the American Medical Association journal the other day. I mean, I read some ads, some beautiful ads, and that lead pamphlet that still got me is How to Control Your Child. I should write a pamphlet, How to Control Your Child, that really showed how. I mean, you could get this kid down to a point where you really had him in an apathy all the time. Now, do you notice there on your tone scale charts that it's hypnotic level should be on there? Yeah, all right. And down there at apathy, by your hypnotic level is just everything's literal. Somebody comes along and he says, Pat and Mike, and so forth, and he tells the fellow a joke, and the fellow says, You say, but Pat and Mike, so and so and so and so, and you try to punch it up. Oh, it's a joke. Oh, ha ha ha. I wonder what he's laughing about, but it doesn't matter. He's no sense of humor. Everything is just going in. He accepts all the words given to him as commands. And you can actually take this person, particularly when he's a little tired, and you can lift your hand up off the table like this. First thing you know, you can get him lifting his hand up off the table and doesn't observe that he's doing it. He's doing a mimicry on you. Can you get that? The mimicry motor control is so interrupted that by you doing this, it is tantamount to a command on him to do this. Now, you get the interruption is imposed then by accidents, illnesses, and training. Accidents, illnesses, training, even accidents or operations, too. They're always bad accidents. Most of them shouldn't happen. But these things interrupt this pattern. Training, always to some degree or other, is putting a block in here. It's putting another eye interposing here so that the motor strip will react to somebody else but this eye. It's very simple to do. But do you notice that a person's ability to move and the tone scale are synonymous? The person in apathy cannot move at all. If you notice, his motions in life are slow. An apathy case. Very slow. So on. He looks tired. He'll tell you he's tired. And so forth. At one step up from there, in grief, you have very practically no motion to amount to anything. You get another step up, and here you're getting the scale of energies, the amount of energy a person has. You get up there to fear. You may have considerable action, but you've got almost continual exhaustion. And if you get up to anger, boy, have you got action. All of it's destructive. If you had an anger case full on, the guy is doing destruction. He may be taught, however, to do something mechanically on a motor strip level. But don't ask him to ever do an adjudication about the thing. Therefore, you could teach a workman practically any mechanical action, regardless of where he is in the tone scale, and make him go through the motions. You have driven his eye to complete apathy on the subject of controlling him. Until you have interposed you in here directing his motor strip. You understand? So that you could take him on any subject and drive him down to an apathy. The definition of apathy is when I is not controlling the motor strip. That's real apathy. Where the motor strip is being continually handled by past trainings. It would be much better. Now, here it is a matter of training. If you can take a man's hands and put them through the action of what he is supposed to do, and just keep putting his hands through the action, explaining to him what he's supposed to do at the same time, putting his hands through the actions that he's supposed to do. If you can just keep that up with an individual, you can train him into a stimulus response pattern that he'll follow through very reliably. Such things as tying an intricate electrical knot. If you can just guide his hands through tying the intricate electrical knot. And then tie another knot. And keep it up. The first thing you know, the fellow go on and tie these knots. You interrupt this. That's one kind of training. You can't teach a man to think that way, but you can teach him to go through mechanical motions. You can teach him to drive that way. Driving requires very little judgment. It's almost all mechanical reaction, honestly. You see something, you do something, it's pretty well spotted. But that interruption. Now, as a person then goes through life, what is the primary thing that happens to him? It's an interruption of action. And he is at the point on the tone scale to the level that his action has been interrupted. There is probably even a proportion involved here. I don't know what the proportion is, but if you said that a quarter of his action had been interrupted, this would bring him down to 2.5. Half his action had been interrupted, bring him down to 2. I don't know that this is it, but if more than half, bring him down to 1.5. Much more than half, up to about three quarters, he'd be in the fair. But how much of his action has been interrupted in life? Now, there's actually a sensation of motion which a person perceives. A person perceives that one has moved. If one remembers the last time he was held still, and I don't mean now by somebody asking one to sit still. I mean held still, or held down, or pinned back with something. If he could just, doesn't have to remember any words or anything, but just get a perception out of the motion of how it felt to try to wrest himself free and be unable to. Just get a perception in himself of how it felt to try to wrest himself free from this position he couldn't get out of. If he just gets that perception two or three times, all of a sudden he'll feel better. You get an cumulative arrestings. You get cumulative arrestings of action all through life, you see. And every time action is arrested, here is a delivered impulse. I says, you're being held still. Move. You get a kickback. Can't move. I says, move. And you get a kickback. Can't move. Move. And then all of a sudden, you get a kickback from that. And I says, my God. And I better get out of here. So it says, run. Next motion. Can't run? Well, cry. Well, crying isn't doing any good. Go ahead, get in. I was tired of living this body anyhow. Now, the most basic thing that can happen to an organism is getting eaten. That's right. Your evolutionary ancestors, back to practically the beginning of time, have been many times et. Sometimes they've been considered palatable, sometimes not so. But being held still against one's will is death. That's being eaten. Because that's the main and predominant reason one would be held still, you see, was to be eaten. That comes up the line as quite the natural and most basic response of an individual is don't be food. Eat, it says, don't be food. Now your eye starts to hand out dictation here on the subject of the procurement of food. And supposing I is held back from procuring the food, you get the same descent down the tone scale. I says, ah, I just received a message here from olfactory. Rutabagas. I says, okay. Cameras, lights, action. Let's go. Something checks the approach. And right away, the first motion toward the rutabagas is good. And okay. And then he's walking in the muddy field, however, and he notices he's being impeded, and he says, what the devil? And, oh, it's mud. Mud's holding me back. Well, that's not so bad. If I just walk a little more carefully here on these ridges, then I'll get over and get to the rutabagas. Okay. Well, the only trouble was with the ridges, they were such softer. As a matter of fact, the fella could go clean on up to his ankles on this stuff. And shoes are getting pretty muddy. Oh, the hell with the rutabagas. Bored with the rutabagas, but next thought is, I'm pretty hungry. The devil with these doggone ridges that are impeding me from getting the rutabagas, and the fellow will antagonistically get through. Now, you see, he's developing enough energy to plow through the soft mud or to plow through the soft fur of the animal he's killing or whatever it is. And if he can't get through the ridges, he will stop worrying about the rutabagas or even stop thinking about the rutabagas, and he will actually exert some destructive action toward the thing which is impeding him. You ever see a man kick a car that wouldn't run? Now, the next thing to do is, the fellow finds out that he's going to sink up to his hips in these doggone field. This field is really dangerous. He's liable to keep there. He better get out of there. If he can't lick it, he better run from it. If he can't run, he just says, well, poor me. Maybe there's another man around, and he'll help me out of here. And if there isn't even any other man around to do anything about, well, the fellow says, the only reason I must be stuck here in the mud is because something wants to eat me. This mud wants to eat me, but here I am, so I just give up. There's your approach toward interrupted. Now, in other words, if a person in life, you might say, is actually physically interrupted in the early stages of his life, particularly interrupted to a certain degree and to a certain quantity, let us postulate that there are 1,000 units that can be absorbed. When 500 of these 1,000, these 1,000 thought units, these units come out here, so on, we could postulate it perhaps even a little better by saying there are 1,000 thought units out here that go into effect. Every single time. Did you remember that squeak of my fingernail on the blackboard? Remember? All right, remember it again. Remember it again. Remember it again. Recall it again. I recall it by telling you to recall it. All right, come on up to present time. Each one of these is a computation. It's a computation. There was your antagonism and your anger level. See? You get so much energy of these 1,000 units dammed up in trying to go through this computation. There's a certain amount of force there, energy, and this one could go through every time. But less than this didn't. Less than that didn't on the bulk of the activities of this individual. Let's say his mother would give up at the time he bit. Yeah, that was habitually that way. And let's find out that he could throw such a terrific tantrum that even the little boys in the neighborhood would turn pale and run. In other words, this thing kept getting through all the time at this level. He kept winning at this level. And the first thing you know, he starts omitting these other levels. Because he omits these levels for the simple reason that every time he tries to use them, they run into past circuits which are jammed for that action. It says, be happy. Let's be happy and approach it swiftly. That circuit is jammed. It's got... There have been 872,000 times in his life when he said happily, let's approach, and he couldn't. Well, along about the last 100,000 of them, his idea was of approach is just no. So he'll drop down to the next conservative approach and so forth. In other words, he'll just keep coming down the line then, and here he'll finally get into action. And by George, he gets into action there, and he finds action is there, and he's had to be mad at so many objects at this time. So many objects have been mad at him, and so many people have been mad at him, and he's been so mad at so many people, and madness was what succeeded all the way along the line anyhow, and there he is at 1.5. He is vibrating, you might say, at 1.5. 1.5 is the successful action, the only successful action. Once a person has come down to that as a successful action, he doesn't go back up. This side of processing. He can fluctuate around on that area. But what's his physiological aspect? He has full autonomic mobilization for violent attack, complete inhibition of craniosacral, thoracolumbar in full action, respiration and pulse fast and deep, stasis of gastrointestinal tract, blood to peripheral vascular system. I hope you know now. And by the way, that's what'll be wrong with him physiologically.
because you can pump a guy full of just so much adrenaline for just so much space of time. You can keep him in an emergency anger status for just so much space of time. You've got the food all sitting there and waiting to be fed into the bloodstream at just so much space of time. He will develop a certain physiology, definite physiology. He's your broad, square, very square, rather overweighted, and so forth, individual. I came up the tone scale the other day, 0.0001 points, and 2 inches came off of my belt line, just about like that. It's quite remarkable, the changes that will occur as you bring a person up this tone scale. You change them physiologically. They're only really in good physical condition, really good physical condition, around 3-5 and up. But here you have a situation where this fellow's all mobilized. Isn't it funny that people at 1-5 uniformly have depository illnesses like arthritis? They're all mobilized. They hold on to this stuff. So on. Their give and take reaction in life is very simple. Somebody wants something, get angry. You want something, get angry. It's very simple, it's elementary. You can look right across the line on this. Ethics. What the hell do you need ethics for? All you have to do is get angry. You look across the line, various other things. I don't know how many charts are still here, but if you read across here on your tone scale chart. Now, the very funny part of anger is anger is destructive. And this fellow will start to swing a pattern of this character. Notice the beaten appearance of people in his vicinity. The girl that has a 1-5 for a husband, folks, she's at least down there to 1-1. He usually gets her driven down to 0-5 where he gets through. Now, his command over his environment, of course, being an anger command over the environment, is very interesting. But he smashes or destroys others of his environment. Very funny thing how fast an anger, however, will spin in. If he gets hung up by anger, he doesn't easily go on down the scale. He doesn't beat down the scale, because now we're talking about the difference of an individual's reaction over a period of a few minutes and the period of a reaction over a long period of life. Just as a person finds it a little bit difficult to get over having been angry 5 minutes ago. After life has got him fairly well fixed, his pattern of life has come out along this band, he'll fix there. He doesn't get over that. But he doesn't get much below it. He doesn't get much above it. But if you break an anger dramatization, the person's success line is anger. This is his action line, his success line, his step line. This is the way he's procured things. He's found the give and take of life has been along about in this line. His attitude, though, is one of failure. And if he breaks, he's already below 2-0. And if somebody turns around and gets 3 times as angry as he is, he doesn't go through 0-5. He just dives into apathy right straight. Boom! You get a 1-5, and if you thoroughly enough break a 1-5 dramatization, he'll kill himself. He'll certainly talk about killing himself, but it takes a terrific amount to break a 1-5 dramatization. Terrific amount. You're fascist. Inevitably, is carrying with him poison for self-destruction and so on. He's going to win against others or die trying. Heil Hitler. Matter of fact, most of his boys that were at the tone band of fascism and so forth, they knocked themselves off, just boom. You break these boys back. You see, they're just right there above fear. You break these boys back in their dramatization, and they'll just... They find out they can't destroy anything in the environment. They'll destroy all they've got left in the environment over which they have control. because they will destroy anything over which they have control. But they would rather destroy the stuff out there than here, although they don't care too much about this either. You get destruction of the environment along about that band. It's very interesting. Another thing is that society is always taking a very, very strange look at your one-fives. Your one-fives are thought to be forceful. Leaders, this, that. A bunch of people in fear will elect the one-five. And yet, his actual worth to society compared to apparent worth, he's insincere, heavy liability, possible murderer, even when intentions avowedly good will bring about destruction. Now, if you boys stick together with me, we're going to take Czechoslovakia and Austria, and we're going to make the German Reich a great Reich.
Sure.
Come along, boys. We're going to really fix you up. Glory. We're going to sell you all glory. Great. And then all of a sudden, you've got a dead Germany on your hands. You put one of these one-fives in charge of a labor crew. Got no machinery involved. You just put him in charge of this labor crew. Count the accidents. These boys are really beat down quick in his labor crew, but he's obviously doing a fine job. He has these fellows really ordered around. The army during the last war finally found out that one-fives weren't automatically to be appointed to sergeantsies. It took them 160 years to discover this. That it was a bad thing to do. But, troops actually don't fight well under a 1-5. They get beaten back by the 1-5. They get afraid. So, now you've got this crew of men. You're going to have a bad turnover. Personnel, they're going to have accidents. But Lord help you if you put him in charge of a crew and machinery. Because the machinery will really break down. The very funny part of this fellow is that he's the kind of a fellow that's liable to get the Medal of Honor or something of the sort. But don't ever confuse worth to the society with worth in war. That's a totally artificial value at this day and age. A man's value in attacking the enemy when there is an enemy to be attacked is very fine, but remember this is destruction. And how well a 1-5 can carry out his action in battle. He's a good soldier. No doubt about that. He's kind of bad to have around the station when there's no battle going on because he'll start a mutiny. If there's no other way he can fix the ship or the station or the trucks up, he'll think of that. Well, he always got action. Now, his ability to handle responsibility is what's very interesting, because this fellow is forceful. You understand? This fellow can handle men. Obviously, they're afraid of him. And yet, he's very respectful to you, too. Very often, your 1-5 is very respectful. Because, you see, there's always some fear and a direction towards succumbing. He won't, however, respect anybody lower on the tone scale. But he'll sometimes respect people higher. This is almost a caste system, by the way. There's the leading order of hens. And this fellow will do almost anything to get responsibility if you've really got a good, solid 1-5 with a lot of volume, so on. And he'll be respectful to you, and he'll toady you up to you, and he'll flatter you, and so forth. But he'll get some responsibility. He'll fix him. Because he wants aid and assistance in carrying forward destruction. When you start to give this fellow orders, you get some interesting things. You say, now, how about going and building that, stringing that telephone line, and so forth, and you've got this crew of men in a truck, and he goes out there to string the telephone line. You understand that if he's been well-educated, you could have indoctrinated him into stringing telephone lines. There's no doubt about this, or even indoctrinating into ordering men to spring telephone lines. And you'll only get this stuff filtering through slightly, but you'll get it through. He'll express it, regardless. And you talk to him about it. You know, that's a terrific telephone line we're stringing there. There's a swell way to go about this. It's a very important line, and the best way to go about this is we've got a special truck that'll take care of this, and so forth. And you get this special truck and string that line, and so you drive out the next day to find out why he's doing on this line. You find out the special truck isn't there. Well, why isn't the special truck there? Did you tell me to bring the special truck out? Yes, sure I did. Well, I think I remember now. But it was much better, and so forth. A couple of other things aside, we didn't bring it. He didn't hear you. That's the truth of the matter. He stood right there in front of you and nodded, and he didn't hear you. If you'd have said, you know, this truck we've got, it's very dangerous. The last two times it went out, men fell from the tower on it. They were killed. It's a very dangerous truck. I want you to be careful of this truck. Oh, yes, sir, I'll be careful of the truck. You go on out there the next day, he's got the truck out there. Not because, really, you told him it was dangerous. It was because you put in a communication on a line that he'd understand. Death, destruction, knock it apart. It's dangerous. It's a terrific emergency. A lot of people are dying. A lot of people will die unless this is done. You've got to act to save this situation. It's almost gone. This stuff he will listen to. But you say, there's a swell new machine which will fix all this up for you. You're talking to a guy who's deaf. It actually is an actual energy shutoff. This isn't just the fact that he just doesn't listen. He just doesn't come in along that line. You take something like, you give this fellow an order, and you say, when you get out to the field out there, why, I'd like you to tell Sergeant Hokes to send the Rudy rod back. And it'll probably be here about 4 o'clock, I guess, so you tell him to send it back. Okay, 4 o'clock, you. Rudy rod. No Rudy rod. 5 o'clock, no Rudy rod. Business is through that day. Next morning you drive out. Where the hell is that Rudy rod? He's got you down at his tone scale now, you see. And you see this other sergeant, and he says, what? The Rudy rod? You told me to bury it. I couldn't understand what you were talking about, but now look, I didn't tell you to bury it. But that's the message he got. Not to send it back, to do something else with it. And probably it was not the Rudy rod anyway, it was the Ford Jeep. I mean, the Willie's Jeep that he had, and he was supposed to exchange that for the Ford, and you wanted him to send back the Rudy rod. You can get the most fantastic twists of communication from through a 1-5 that I know of. It's fabulous what happens. You tell him one thing, and when you ask a 1-5 to act as a communications relay point, an executive takes his life and his sanity in his hands. Because it'll go some other way. And if you had a 1-5 as a girl, remember, lots of girls could be 1-5s too, and if you, because they're less seldom, I mean, they're less often 1-5s. Girls are usually lower on the tone scale if they're bad off at all. If you were unlucky enough to have a secretary who would be at this level, boy, what wouldn't happen to your correspondence? Boy, it'd be just fantastic. And you, what would happen to your appointments? Tell Jones I'll see him at 2 o'clock. So she calls Smith and she says, you won't be there that day. There's automatic responses. You actually have to have a little experience with this to really appreciate how gruesome it can get. Now, another thing that's going to happen to this 1-5 is he's not going to have as many days out as maybe a lot of other people, but he's going to have days out, believe me. He's going to be sick. When he gets sick, He will get sick along the operational, I require lots of treatment, I'm leaving for Mayo's clinic order. He gets quite sick. He gets mad at his sicknesses, too. It's awfully interesting to hear him rave and rant about his arthritis. My goddamn knees keep...
That's the way it goes. Well, it's interesting, too, to have one of these fellows around because the ethic level.
A 1-5 won't do as many crooked things as people below that level, but he'll do things for you that are crooked. All of a sudden, the cops walk in and they say, how about the lumber? And you say, what lumber? Well, the lumber that was down there on your project that you had picked up and so forth from Jones's project. I didn't have any lumber. What the hell are you talking about? So you call Mr. 1-5 down on the job that you've got down there as a foreman because he's so forceful, and he says, well, confidentially, boss, it was sitting over there, and I just thought you needed it, and so forth, so I brought it along. Is something wrong in it? He knows there's something wrong in it. He'll destroy you just as quick as he'll destroy something else.
The funny part of it is that his general persistence,
you get a fellow up the tone scale, he can hit a few disappointments without going bluey. But a 1-5's persistence is not good. He'll tackle something, he gets anger on it very quickly, and he'll keep running along that line of anger on the job unless he hits an obstacle. He'll keep going unless he hits some kind of a very solid obstacle, something that drives him down a little bit. He'll quit. And he's not very fast to think of some new solution. You'll come out and you'll say, but why in the name of common sense didn't you so-and-so? Well, we would have done that except, by the way, the next statement is a lie. He'll give you a lie. He'll tell you why he didn't do that. He hit this obstacle, they went plowing across the field, and there was a piece of cable buried across the field, and he didn't know the cable was there, and so forth, and you go out there, and he's been on the job 3 hours with four men at God knows how much pay, and the field isn't finished, which it should have been, because he hit the cable. But the fact of the matter was, he didn't have to hit that cable at all. And he'll probably tell you that the machine broke or something like that, and then you'll find out later that it was because he hit this cable. It makes very interesting, makes management terribly interesting, having these people. The military services, you had a lot of fellows who in civil life were at 2-5, were at 2, somewhere up there, that would hit the armed services and, of course, get some more of this hold business. Then they go down the scale and sit down here at 1-5. They would ordinarily have been about 2-5, something like that. When they come out of the Army, see, there they are, a couple of points lower on the tone scale than they ought to be. That's why we should have universal military training. Very good for people. You know, you can take a bunch of guys who are fairly well up the tone scale. All you've got to do is stand them out in the field and start and stop their actions independently. If you can only figure out a system by which they elect to continue along a certain course and then figure out some way to interrupt that course. And if you can figure out how to get them withdrawing from something and then arrest their withdrawal. You get them to use their free self-determinism and then show them why they shouldn't have. Physically show them why they shouldn't have. If you can do this, you can get them down the tone scale to a point of apathy where they will follow orders very good and they won't worry and they'll go out in the battlefield and lie down for dear old Secretary of Defense or something. That's good. I could teach a sergeant tricks on this stuff, by the way. I look at myself in shame, in horror. When I was first got into college, I needed a little recreation. Life was dull. A fella came up to me and he says, the Marine Reserves are organizing a 20th Regiment. Why don't you come down? So I went down, and I found out nobody down there knew to the rear march, to the rear march, to the rear march. And I happened to know to the rear march, to the rear march, to the rear march. So I went around to the captain, and I said, in view of the fact that I've been an admiral in the Greek Navy or something, so I've forgotten what I told him, I said, I'll join up if you give me a sergeantcy. I was 19. He looked at me. Then he went out and drilled him the next Sunday, and everybody fell flat on his face. He finally came out at the end, just at the end of his drill period, and he said, well, squads right or left as the case may be. They had marched it down in Rock Creek Park. They had marched down along a line where there was a precipice on this side, and he couldn't get away from it. So he finally sung out to me, and he said, Hubbard, he says, let's take the men back to the parade field. I said, aye, aye, sir. We went back. The only reason I knew anything about drilling is been hanging around with the Marines off and on. I was a Navy junior. So, anyway, I figured out I might as well cast my act. So, a few drill periods. He couldn't find anybody else that could drill. Nobody knew how to drill. Oh, it was a long time. All the people of World War I, nobody listened to them anymore. They were out on the streets, you know, where they're unshaven and dirty and walking along and kind of beaten looking and so on. You couldn't find any men that knew anything about drilling. So they made me a first sergeant. So I got my hair cut off. Got it sticking up like bristles, pig's back. I stood in front of a mirror for a while, and I got this 1-5 look on my face, the way I'd seen the most successful sergeants look. I cultivated a method of talking like that. And, jeez, I even scared myself. And if you diabolically follow, just as a mimicry pattern, without any understanding, I'd known a lot of Marine sergeants, a lot of Marine top kicks, tough boys, and seen them handle people, and you just follow a pattern. You just do what they did. And you say, somebody comes up to you, and he says, you know, have you got any easy jobs around here? I'd really like to volunteer for something if I possibly could. And you say, well, can you drive a car? Can you? Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, looking for somebody that could drive a car, come here. Wheelbarrow. You drive that for the rest of the day. And a fellow walks up to you and says, you know, I think... You what? What is your rank? Are you captain now? Oh, captain, huh? Going to think. Well, I have some thinking for you to do. There's a latrine to be dug back out here. And you can go out there and think with a shovel in your hands. Just keep it interrupted. Don't let anybody get free or fancy or anything like that. And if you happen to notice somebody's having a real hard time doing something, but he's still trying, you really fix him. We had a fat boy, very fat boy. He must have been way up. There's a way of falling on a rifle. You go at a dead run. Your rifle's charged like this. You go at a dead run. You can actually throw yourself down, throw the butt of the rifle in the ground, come up like this, lying prone, and fire. It's the method used by the Marines to keep a wave of men firing, a wave of men running, and a wave of men starting to run so that you get an increasing wave action toward an objective. Very interesting. But boy, that is really a tough exercise. And until a fellow can, with complete abandon, throw himself down on the butt of his rifle, bong, and throw himself over, he just might as well quit. He'll kill himself. I found out that every time this fellow did it, he'd kill himself practically, so we kept him at it. It was about 95 down there at Quantico in the Virginia sun, and it was, oh, dusty, dry, dusty. Sweat was pouring off him. His khaki just completely black with sweat. Kept him at it because he wasn't doing it well. And let the other fellow stand around and see that you're keeping him at it because he couldn't do it well. After a while, they just go down into apathy, too. So the fellow just completely caked with dust, which turned into mud. He was in complete exhaustion. And finally, he hit his rifle against a rock, and the stalk split. So I gave him a deck court-martial for wrecking a rifle. I hate myself.
Just model after typical top kicks in the Marine Corps. That was all. I mean, that's the way they operate. What you're doing is destroying the self-determinism of men. And if you destroy their self-determinism sufficiently, you can then interpose you here. You keep up tricks like this. If you can actually make a guy fall down and get in the mud and do all the rest of this sort of thing, the theory is that if you get him out there in front of a line of enemy firing, I is saying, run. Of course, the Marine Corps doesn't depend completely on this mechanism. I'll tell you their surefire little Jim Dandy assurance that this, but this is saying, run. And the top kick says, hard. And they all go forward and they all get shot. Simple mechanism. That's right, because his self-determinism in here. But how does he do it? He does it by keeping them from raising their arm. He does it with close order drill. He handles their bodies to the tune of his appearance and his presence until he is I. Now, if he can be 1-5, then his orders are 1-5 orders, which will cause 1-5 action. And that is just fine for military services. But boy, that is really bad for industry. By the way, the little handy Jim Dandy mechanism is the gunnery sergeant. The gunnery sergeant in a Marine company stands 2 paces to the rear. And the reason he stands 2 paces to the rear of the last rank is so that he shoots anybody that turns and runs. That's his orders. It's pretty hard to make a bunch of naked-breasted men stand up to various small caliber slugs which are flying with considerable velocity in their direction. But you see, this mechanism can work and does work. But it only works by driving people down the tone scale into a complete regimentation. Now, when you have a system which requires sentient operation, which require brains, where you've got complex machinery, that sort of thing, this is not the method of training that you can use. Completely not. You've got to train these people along a self-determined line in order to raise their self-determinism with regard to their machinery. Because if you don't, they are going to be fastened at some emotional response level toward every motion they have to make. And if you are putting them up against things that are moving, things that have action and coordination, they will come at a tone level, if they're trained like this, whereby they'll destroy the equipment. They'll go on through the motions and everything else, but the final wind-up is they'll destroy their equipment one way or the other. You ever notice how hard war is on machinery? You ever looked at machinery which is used by troops in action? You'll know what I'm talking about. Not a doggone thing may have happened to this airplane, and it's only flown 150 hours, and it's a piece of junk. Nothing happened to it. There's just something about it. People along these various tone bands, to the degree that it shows on the chart, will make junk out of equipment, and they'll make junk out of the people they're surrounded with. You get the fact then that there's actually a mechanism involved here by which the self-determinism can be willfully interrupted by another person. Parents, teachers, in an individual's life, keep imposing this time and time and time again, restraints, and then they set up a whole verbal line of restraints to set up on top of the actual motion. You can't go, you've got to stay there, you know, all this sort of stuff. And you get a set emotional reaction, finally, which will sit with the person physiologically. He'll get located into a certain level because of various restraints of his self-determinism. And the restraint of his self-determinism winds up in fixing his behavior so that he, as I, cannot alter it. The environment is establishing his behavior. He is not establishing his behavior below 2-0 on the chart. But he is increasingly establishing what he should do as he goes on up the chart. And believe me,
if you want anything left of equipment. If you want a person to be able to run fast equipment, do anything with it that is effective, or to be in the vicinity of motion, or a person to engage in certain well-coordinated motions, you'd certainly better look from 2-5 up, because a person cannot stand up to motion without getting emotional if he's too low on the tone scale. Thank you very much.